I'm Jack Beatty. This is The Connection. The president's primary job, FDR said, is to educate. Last night, President George W. Bush played the teacher, carefully laying out the scientific promise and moral perils of stem cell research.
I have concluded that we should allow federal funds to be used for research on these existing stem cell lines, where the life and death decision has already been made. Leading scientists tell me research on these 60 lines has great promise that could lead to breakthrough therapies and cures. This allows us to explore the promise and potential of stem cell research without crossing a fundamental moral line by providing taxpayer funding that would sanction or encourage further destruction of human embryos that have at least the potential for life.
We elect presidents to make political decisions, and Bush sought to balance his campaign promises with his future political hopes. How did the speech, Bush's first fireside chat, play with you? Will his limited approval of federal funding for embryonic stem cell research be enough to move regenerative medicine forward? Or will it force scientists, as one said last night on CNN, to fight a 21st century war with World War II weapons? Alternatively, has Bush crossed the moral line and put the country on a course to eugenics and worse? On CBS, Dan Rather said this story was too complicated for TV, but we will wade into the complexity, into the political, ethical, scientific, and business ramifications of Bush's decision this hour on The Connection. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join us online at theconnection.org. Joining us on the phone from the NPR studio in Washington is Frank Foer, a staff reporter for The New Republic. And in the WBUR studio, we are joined by Adrian Ash, professor of biology, ethics, and the politics of human reproduction at Wellesley College. Good morning to you both.
Hello.
Good morning.
Frank, let's start with you. Give us the political surround of this speech and put it in some perspective. How did this issue enter American politics in the first place?
Well, this debate has really been portrayed as a battle between the religious right on one side and the scientific research community on the other, with the religious right pushing for a ban on federally funded research involving stem cells, embryonic and otherwise. And they were very successful in the mid-90s in forcing Congress to enact some sort of ban. And President Clinton, siding with the research community and their celebrity allies, moved to try to circumvent this ban in the late towards the end of his administration. And Bush came in, and there was an enormous amount of pressure on him for several reasons. The first is that he clearly owed his election in large part to support from the religious right. But more importantly, the Bush administration has been obsessively concerned from the start with winning the support of Catholic voters. And they viewed their decision on this to be extremely important to those efforts, especially after the president journeyed to the Vatican and got a lecture from the Pope on the importance of preserving the sanctity of human life.
Of course, this bid for the Catholic vote, I've seen polls that said as much as 75% of Catholics were in favor of unlimited embryonic federal funding for stem cell research.
That's right. And I think that the Bush administration would probably concede it. Their understanding of Catholic votes is based on polling data that they've collected that breaks the Catholic vote into two categories. One that is orthodox and active is, I think, are the two buzzwords that they use to describe them. And those are the more conservative, more church-going members of the community. And those are the members that they view as essential to their political prospects, as opposed to the more modernist, more secular, less church-going Catholic public.
We call them cafeteria Catholics.
Right.
I was struck, looking at the commentary last night, that the celebrities who were brought forward, Mary Tyler Moore and the rest, were saying that Christopher Reeve were basically saying, well, we like this decision. We wish it could have gone further. But I got a subtext that the subtext to me was, we really like this decision because if there's success with these 60 lines of embryonic stem cells, if this begins to yield medical fruits, the pressure for Bush or for any president to approve full federal funding for more research will be all but irresistible. In other words, that the president has sort of punted, kicked down the road an even bigger decision to come.
See, I'm not sure I agree with the celebrity take on this. I think that the president pretty much sided with the religious right, and I think that his speech last night pretty much created a very strict restrictions on the use of stem cell research. I think that maybe the celebrities are happy because the issue is now bound to be extremely politicized. I think that you could see this last night. Democratic presidential aspirants like John Kerry are already talking about pushing for legislation in Congress that would that would allow federal funding for the use of embryonic stem cell research. And I think that people see this, that Democrats see this as an issue that they could use to bludgeon Bush with and identify him with the right wing of his party.
You think that that there's some traction in that?
I think that there's potential there. You can imagine the ads that the Democratic candidate could cut in the next election that says that Bush is so tied to the religious right that he won't allow this very basic medical research that could help suffering people in your own family.
We want to turn to Adrian Ash, professor of biology, ethics, and the politics of human reproduction at Wellesley. Adrian, give us a bioethical perspective on this speech last night. Did it how did it resonate with you?
Well, first I should say that I'm one bioethicist. There are many of us, and we don't all have the same perspective. I will say that I think most bioethicists would want to see this question as much larger and more complicated than pure science, medical progress versus the religious right and respect and sanctification of small numbers of cell clusters called embryos. I think it is much more complicated than that.
Take us into some of the complexities.
First of all, we really don't know how well this research will work. It's true that that's why one does research. We do research to find out whether we will get any benefit. It is still controversial whether adult stem cells and other methods of getting these stem cell lines would work adequately for the information that we're trying to get. That's a scientific question, and since there is much less ethical debate about taking and using stem cells from adults, we could have done that before we entered this morass of embryo research. Second, there's the question of, should we create new embryos rather than use the embryos that already do exist? Now, this is one of the questions that Bush tried to deal with, and there were two ways he could have dealt with it. One was to accept the uses of embryos from all infertility treatments that were considered excess or surplus. He didn't do that. He decided that since some stem cell lines had already been created without federal funding, he would permit the use of this research, of these stem cells, and would not support using existing embryos that had been created from infertility treatments. Now, there may be a very good reason for that, which is that using embryos even from infertility treatments means supporting the creation, perhaps, of more embryos than one needs to implant. The reason one creates what are called surplus embryos is that you create, you retrieve eggs, you fertilize them, and you try to get success in in vitro fertilizations by implanting more embryos than you think will result in a pregnancy. Now, sometimes, of course, you have septuplets, and because all of them took. Sometimes you have more embryos retrieved, fertilized, than you will ever implant. And many people would say that there's a good reason not to do that, that even if embryos are not human persons, they are potential human persons, why create human life that you're not going to try to turn into human life? That doesn't have to be a statement about the sanctity of the embryo, but it can be an appreciation of the gravity of the creation that you are making.
Did you think the president balanced these considerations last night?
Well, I don't. He made a political decision. He made a decision that some people will call and have called the fruit of the poisoned tree. That is, we won't dirty our hands by creating these embryos, but we'll use existing embryos and existing stem cell lines that have already been created. One could say that if it's bad to use embryos in this way, then it shouldn't matter who creates them. There have been discussions in this in bioethics before. Should we use data obtained from immoral experiments? Mm-hmm. That's a question on which bioethics is not resolved. Mm-hmm. Some people say, for exactly this kind of reason, yes, the experiments were immoral, the experimenters were immoral, but the data may be useful. Some people say it is supporting immorality even to use data, no matter how good the data could be, gained by immoral purposes.
But isn't it just characteristic of the human condition that we often, and tragically, have to do even evil that good may come?
I don't really like saying yes or no to that. Perhaps that's the case. I think that bioethics is trying to take stands that don't want to support doing evil that good may come. I think there are perhaps times that that's the case, but I think that they are rare, and I would like to see them rare. I mean, as people talk about abortion being something that should be legal, safe, and rare, I think it might be argued that embryos, so-called excess embryos, should be legal, safe, and rare. I think we want in vitro fertilization. I think we want to see children created. I also think we don't want to see embryos needlessly created. Now, there might be great benefits to people with a range of medical conditions from the research that would be done. We really don't know that. One has to look at the rather few benefits that have come from the Human Genome Project in terms of medical therapy, even though in 15 years of genome research we have mapped and sequenced the human genome.
And we'll come back to that in just a moment, Professor. Thank you. We're talking about President Bush's stem cell decision this hour on The Connection. Has the decision changed your view of the president? Join the conversation when we get back. We're at 1-800-423-8245. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Jack Beatty, this is The Connection. We're talking about President Bush's stem cell decision with my guest Frank Foer, staff reporter for The New Republic, and Adrian Ash, the Henry Luce Professor of Biology, Ethics, and the Politics of Human Reproduction at Wellesley College. Also joining us is Mike West, CEO of Advanced Cell Technology. Mike West, what are the business echoes and resonances of this decision last night?
Well, you know, the technology, the embryonic stem cell technology, originated out of biotech back in 1995 purely from private monies and so on. Of course, the biotech industry has this huge interest in going out and translating these really remarkable cells into new therapies, and very enthusiastic on that score. But I have to say, and as remarkable as this may sound, I know many of us have this view of business that we're all out to line our pockets. My motivation in starting the embryonic stem cell project back in 1995 was humanitarian. In fact, it's the reason I went into medical research in the first place. And the reason we pushed so hard for federal funding was not to line our pockets. You know, the companies don't benefit, for the most part, from federal monies. Federal funding goes into, Harvard University Medical School, Wellesley College, and other institutions to do basic research. And indeed, if they make discoveries with that money, they file patents, and then we have to go pay the universities for those discoveries. The reason we pushed for the federal funding was, we'd rather live in a world where these diseases are our history, and this requires hundreds of fold more money that we could possibly marshal in the private business sector to accomplish this goal.
Does this decision of the president's make it harder or easier for you to raise money on Wall Street, for corporations to raise money, for people to take risks in investing in biotech corporations?
Well, I think it's a mixed story. As I said, we'll have to now pay royalties and monies to universities for all, because they're going to be competing with us, literally, in advancing this technology and filing patents and that sort of thing. I suppose it helps us in terms of people are learning about this new technology. And, when we go out and talk to investors about regenerative medicine, at least now they already have heard of it and they know what it's all about. So it's benefited us, I suppose, from that point of view.
You were quoted in the Boston Globe the other day saying that if these decisions about stem cell research and cloning go the wrong way, you were going to pack up and move your company to Britain. Are you staying now?
Well, we don't have any intention to do that. I was pressed on this point. Would you, if you had to? We're really committed to translating these therapies into the clinic. And, working with these cells, seeing what they can do, I don't think this is hype. I've been accused of, hyping this technology. Sure. I don't think it's hype to call them miracle cells, in quotation marks. Mm-hmm. They do things in the laboratory dish we've never seen anything ever do before. Mm-hmm. On one side of the dish you'll see beating heart muscle cells. Mm-hmm. On the other side you'll see cartilage and bone. If you allow them to grow in three dimensions, they make things like intestine and other tissues mm-hmm. that we've never been able to help people with before. And so we're really excited about them. The ethics side of the debate, which I think is really the limiting factor here, people mm-hmm. feel the opportunities are great,
right.
but are we crossing some moral line?
Right.
I fundamentally disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
These cells are coming from a stage of human development where individuation has not occurred. This little ball of cells can become even two people or one person, mm-hmm. or in the case of human chimeras, which actually exist in nature, they may just become a kidney. Mm-hmm. They don't have, they have not individualized, and I think it's illogical to ascribe to them the status of a person when they're just living cells
yeah.
in the dish.
Yeah. Thank you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tim is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hello.
Good morning. I was wondering if the professor might venture just a very brief discussion of exactly what these cells are going to do in order to possibly treat the various diseases that have been targeted. I've never heard any discussion of that. I just hear the linkage made that these cells
sure.
will be used to treat these diseases, and they never talk about the scientific theory. I don't want to get into the laboratory technology
sure.
aspect, but
yeah.
just talk a little bit about the theory and what the scientists think is going to happen. I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks very
Thank
much.
You. Mike West?
Well, these cells stand at the base of the developmental tree. So we call cells that can branch out and form different kinds of cells, stem cells. But these are sort of the, you know, the mother of all stem cells, or the trunk of the tree of cellular life. And how we coax them into becoming any kind of cell is actually easier than it may sound. They naturally, if you just let them go, start forming cells and tissues of all kind, although they don't form a human being. And all we need to do is the relatively easy thing of saying, you know, nudge them this way, nudge them that way. And already, just in the last couple of years, with just a very small handful of people working on this, cells that we thought would make me difficult to make, you know, coaxing them from the beginning of life all the way through to, say, a beta cell mm-hmm. for diabetes, which we mm-hmm. thought would be a real challenge, has already been accomplished. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we think with proper funding now, hopefully in place, we're going to be seeing that you're going to be hearing about in the next few years, a steady flow of new discoveries of cells we've never been able to make before now available.
Devoutly to be hoped. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lou is on the line. Hello.
Hello. I, of course, like you, tuned into WSPH last night, primarily for me to see what Karl Rove and Karen Hughes and other political advisors had determined that the president should say in order to secure probably the best possible political results from these challenging questions. I must confess to being a bit cynical, or perhaps realistic enough to believe that George and his advisors care very much more, or at least as much, about the politics of the issue as the substance of the issue.
But you had a point about Leon Cass, the chairman.
Well,
as
the president spoke, I perked up when I heard the name Dr. Leon Cass of the University of Chicago, and that he would be named to head up the select panel of academics. Well, on a personal note, and to keep it short, I've known Leon Cass since we were kids in kindergarten. We grew up together, went to grammar school, high school, college together, and we used to talk politics endlessly. Over the years, Leon's progressive views have become more and more conservative. Mine have remained, shall we say, in the Barney Frank school. Today,
Are you suggesting that this may be a stacked commission?
Well, that's what I was getting mm-hmm. around to. Will this be a stacked commission mm-hmm. of academics, of theologians, mm-hmm. of philosopher kings and queens, mm-hmm. Somewhat similar to having people from Philip Morris yet again review the data on whether or not smoking is really harmful to oneself, to have Rockwell, talk about the virtues of the ABM.
Right, we've got the point. Frank Foer, is this another Social Security Commission? The President's Commission has been, people have charged that it's stacked with people who want to privatize Social Security. Is this?
Well, let me just respond to his first point. I don't think actually that the President was acting out of politics. I actually think that he took a rather principled position last night. I mean, he was basically affirming the position that he had taken during the campaign. And, there's all this pressure on him to move to the middle right now. And I don't think that the solution that he came up with last night was a move to the middle. You know, all the talk yesterday was that he was going to be moving towards this Solomonic compromise, the so-called FRIST agreement that would have allowed for the continuation, that would have allowed for the research on the embryos that were slated to be discarded. But as far as Leon Cass and the commission goes, I'm sure that, you know, in some ways it'll be like the Social Security Commission in that it will be a reflection of the president's own beliefs and agenda. But I don't think that Leon Cass is by any stretch a crank or a conservative or a far right wing nut. He's somebody who thinks that moral limits should be placed on technology and on science. He's afraid that we're heading towards a brave new world, and he wants to proceed slowly.
Hmm. Adrian Ash, you were on President Clinton's, a similar commission that President Clinton had. What's your reaction to this commission? And
I was on people? The health reform task force that was created in 1993. I've not served on the National Bioethics Advisory Commission that does exist. I have been a staff member with a state bioethics commission in New Jersey. These commissions can be very important. Now, we already have a National Bioethics Advisory Commission. It's not clear from the Bush announcement whether that commission, the one he's proposing to be chaired by Leon Kass, will preempt the existing Clinton-created National Bioethics Advisory Commission. These commissions generally have bioethics people with many different views. Leon Kass is an eminent and respected bioethicist with conservative views, more conservative than some bioethics people, not as conservative as others.
Do we know who the other members of the commission are?
No, as far as I know, we don't know. I've not heard who the others might be. My guess is that there will be a range of views, some from within established bioethics, some theological, some from social science, some from the medical community. In general, what makes bioethics commissions work well is the range of representation and the careful deliberation that bioethics commissions can engage in. I have been impressed with the work that bioethics commissions can do, and I would like to have confidence that one chaired by Leon Kass will not be a stacked commission, and will come up with careful, modulated views.
Yes.
I think it's important to recognize the potential of science and also the limits that we might want to place on scientific
right.
alleged progress.
All right. Mike West, are you involved with one of these commissions here in Massachusetts?
No, I'm not. We in the private sector, we just had to form our own. So both at my previous company, Geron, and here at our company, Advanced Cell, we simply invited ethicists and other people to form an ethics advisory board of our own to look over our shoulder and give us advice and point out if we're doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's the extent of what we can do in the private sector.
Right. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rachel is on the line. Hello.
Oh, hi. What a subject this is. My feeling is that Mary Shelley, the writer, addressed this stem cell research and the Human Genome Project when she wrote Frankenstein. So I don't call it the Human Genome. I call it the Frankenstein Project. If I had a magic wand, I would put a moratorium on all medical research. To me,
all medical research.
At this point, I know in my area they had to put a moratorium on building houses because this place was exploding with development. So they just shut it all down. And just so people can just take a breath, it's all going way too fast. And my feeling is that, well, it'll never happen. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, and this is an industry. There's no goodwill here, really. There may be a few people who really have people's best interests at heart. What bothers me is that science never looks at causes of problems. They're looking for the cure. How about looking at the environment? We have to defend ourselves in the environment. I don't see that science has really helped us in the last 50 years. When we walk out the door, I mean, if you're in New York City, people are wearing masks, around the city. The food, we have to worry about what's in our food. We have to take all kinds of immune, all of this.
And we're dealing with the symptoms rather than with this environment, toxic environment that's caused. But of course, sick people, it's hard to ask sick people to wait for us to clean up the environment, but you make a good point and an extreme one, but one we need in our thinking. Thank you.
Can I wait into that?
Sure.
Yes, and I'd like to also.
Okay.
I'm very anxious to address this issue because I've heard it so often. We're living in a unique time, and that frankly puzzles me. You know, when I grew up in the Sputnik era, science was our friend and ally. And amazingly, as we turn into the 21st century, science is this bogeyman. All we hear about Frankenstein and monsters and Brave New World. And it frankly puzzles me. You know, we talk about the natural world and, you know, we wouldn't have all these diseases if we didn't have science and technology. Of course, I think that's wrong. You can hear where I'm going. But today here in the Boston area, we have temperatures of 104 and 105. And we can communicate on the telephone all because of technology. We have air conditioning, which is the result of science and technology. And we have communications. We have penicillin. I wouldn't be here speaking to you if it wasn't for penicillin.
Indeed.
And I don't understand why science and technology is considered the bogeyman. We are people, too. And our goal, indeed my goal, is to alleviate human suffering. And we talk about how rapidly this is happening. I wish it could happen faster. Mm. If we could have a cure for diabetes this afternoon,
yes.
I would turn the world upside down to
of
make
course.
It happen.
And we all would. Adrian?
A couple of things. This morning on Morning Edition, there was a discussion of a commission that had decided that it cost too much money to make airplanes safer, that we could eliminate some of the causes of fuel tank explosions, but that it cost too much and it wasn't going to be done. The recommendation was made that it wouldn't be done. Now, I think that we have to recognize that there's enormous value in medical research, and there's also enormous value in doing many other things to make the world safer. This government that may spend $250 million on embryo research is not necessarily spending $250 million or asking corporations to spend $250 million to make airplanes safer.
Mm.
I think it is appalling to support only pure research, medical research, no matter how valid,
mm-hmm.
when we don't support environmental changes and perhaps curbs on corporate activity that would make other things safer. The medical system cleans up what much of the world creates. Bioethics deals with acute care, life and death situations, some of which are created because an environment is toxic. Now, that is not to say that we shouldn't work to cure diabetes, which may have no environmental cause, but it does mean that many things that cause medical problems are avoidable, but only if we are going to, as a government, be as interested in existing human beings as we are in preserving embryos.
Thank you. We're making the stem cell connection this hour. Join the conversation when we return. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Jack Beatty. This is The Connection. We're putting the stem cell decision under the microscope. Join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stefan is on the line.
Hi, I'm calling as a physician and as someone who has plenty of appreciation for what medical science can do. But nevertheless, I've been really wondering, how is it that we can pull together such an intensive, broad public discourse about an expensive technology that offers relatively little benefit to probably very well-insured people one day in the future, and nowhere near the same kind of discussion on a less expensive technology like, say, vaccinating all the children in America's inner cities? And why is the discourse never able to slant in that direction?
Adrian, you raised this point earlier, Adrian Nash.
Yes, well, I agree with that concern, and I think that we don't spend enough public time really figuring out how we want to allocate our resources, human capital. We spend our time dealing with technology by technology without thinking about how much money do we want to spend on what kind of health care, how much money we want to give to health versus education versus crime versus art. These are all important. And those are the kinds of public discussions that really need to take place rather than getting all excited about should we or should we not support stem cell research. That is a discussion we need to have, but we need to have it as a part of a much broader discussion. I would hope that any new bioethics commission that's created thinks about stem cell research and thinks about vaccinating inner city children and thinks about getting 40 million uninsured people insured.
Hmm. Could I, Mike West, weigh in on this too?
Sure.
It's important to note that when we envisioned these technologies on the blackboard back in 95, they were envisioned to be new tools in the physician's toolbox for age-related degenerative disease. So if you look in the past, every medical school in the country has a department of pediatrics, has a department of obstetrics. We spent enormous resources through the NIH in vaccinations and helping people get rid of infectious disease and improve sanitation and nutrition. And, of course, it's paid off in a big way. But we've always ignored the aged end of the population curve, so that now we live out our lives into the very old years, and when we have age-related degenerative disease, macular degeneration that makes you blind, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, heart failure, we have no tools in the toolbox. We give them.
I would take strong exception to that characterization of how we've invested our resources. I really think that it's striking to me that in America's inner cities and the areas around most major medical schools, the children in America have lower vaccination rates than in many third world countries. I can't see that as evidence of our spending all that much resources on actually vaccinating the children who need it.
My point is the age-related degenerative disease is a far larger and rapidly growing problem. Alzheimer's alone is costing our nation $10 billion a year in costs, and that's just one age-related disease, and with tremendous impact in terms of debility and morbidity and suffering. And to say that, you know, we would take $250,000, a fraction of 1% of what this is costing us every year, to invest in basic technologies that could not only have such dramatic economic benefit to our country in terms of reducing this cost, but the wage of human suffering, I don't think this is disproportionate. I'm not saying we shouldn't worry about our children, but the aged have tend to be, you know, shoved off into nursing homes, and meanwhile we're mounting up these huge bills and the aging of the baby boomers.
Yes.
We need to look forward and think this is a strategic area to expend our money.
Thank you, Stefan.
Can I jump in, Jack?
Sure, Frank Foer.
I think that this debate is happening for several reasons. The first is that obviously the biotech companies are pursuing this very aggressively because, in addition to the medical benefits to be had, there's great profit to be had. Secondly, I think that the debate is really, can be attributed to the celebrity spokesmen who have embraced this cause and managed to put it at the top of the agenda. But third and most profoundly, I think that all these scientific developments are happening extraordinarily quickly. And I think that it engenders both utopian optimism on one hand, the Pollyannish statements about the potential of science. And on the other hand, it clearly induces an incredible amount of anxiety. I would commend to everyone to go on to, actually, I know this sounds self-serving, but my magazine's website, tnr.com, and look at several essays that Leon Cass has written for my magazine. I think that they are...
That's the New Republic.
Right.
Yeah.
The New Republic. I'm sorry. The essays are would probably give people a little bit of insight into where this commission is heading. Mm-hmm. But Cass's essays are also very eloquent statements about technological determinism. When you listen to a lot of people talk about this research, there is the sense that we're just letting the logic of the technology play itself out, that there's something inevitable mm-hmm. about the advances. But Cass makes the assertion that, you know, no, there's nothing inevitable about this. Human beings still can control technology and its advances, and we need to remember that we can assert that sort of control. I think that's why the stem cell debate is so important to people like Cass and a lot of the neoconservative critics of this, because they want to establish a precedent where the government sets some sort of limit on some sort of moral limit on technological progress. And I think this whole debate is a prelude to a much larger debate that we're going to be having very soon on human cloning.
Indeed. Thank you.
I'd like to say something about this that really follows on what has just been said by both people. First of all, I think it's very important to recognize the problems of aging, the problems of an increasingly large older population. I also think, and this relates to what Frank Foer has just said, we use technology often instead of thinking about social, moral, and psychological ways of alleviating difficulty. We imagine that we will solve the problem of diabetes by one particular cure, and maybe we will, or Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, but we don't think about the ways that living with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or diabetes can be made much better for individuals and their loved ones by social services, by changing the way we view what we call suffering, mm-hmm. by changing the way we view health, disability, illness. Mm-hmm. We see illness and disability as shameful and disastrous rather than seeing it as sometimes a part of the human condition. Mm-hmm. I'm not interested in being fatalistic, but sure. I am interested in seeing more ways of looking at a problem than the technological and medical solution to that problem.
Thank you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pratt is on the line. Hello.
Yes, hi. I'm a teacher in Boston of international students who come from all over the world to study here in the U.S., and we've been studying this topic recently, and unfortunately, as the teacher, I end up becoming sort of a defender of everything American, or at least I'm supposed to explain everything, and there's a couple things that I really can't explain to my students, and the main thing is, beyond the basic facts of all this research, why... and I think many of your speakers have started talking this, why we take such a reactive approach rather than a proactive approach when it comes to bioethics. For example, we're all having this program today, and this program is a response to both legislative and technological process as opposed to a sort of preemptive strike to try to get the issues out there in a cool, calm, level-headed environment before any action is going to be taken so that people have a much more informed view. Is there any kind of commission in the United States that is actually has the power to restrict research before the research has begun? I feel like this is a little bit of a Pandora's box, you know, mm-hmm. situation where, well, you know, the research is out there and England is going to get the jump mm-hmm. on us, mm-hmm. you know, so we might as well jump on the bandwagon mm-hmm. or it's too late. Mm-hmm. You know, we're being led down the garden path, but mm-hmm. nobody is here to say, you know what, we have the ability to say we're going to study this thing, we're going to think it through, and then if we agree with it, we're going to let the research go forward.
Yeah.
So that's what they want to know.
Sure. Well, presumably this new commission headed by Leon Cass is going to be doing some of that, looking forward. Was that Frank Foer?
Yeah. I actually think that this, what the caller is talking about is actually happening with the debate over reproductive cloning. Congress looks like it's going to pass some sort of legislation imposing a moratorium on reproductive cloning. And I think that there is actually a rather substantive debate, important debate, that's starting to be had on the subject.
Mike West, of course, you're keenly interested in reproductive cloning, are you not?
No, we're interested in the medical uses of cloning, using these cloning technologies to make cells, these embryonic cells, identical to the patient. Mm-hmm. Let me just back up and just paint for you what's in my mind listening to this conversation. Mm-hmm. I think of medical research as trying to rescue people in a burning building. You know, their bodies are burning down around them. They're losing their lives, and they're looking through the windows at us all, watching their. We can see them, you know, dying in our midst. And you have, of course, visit these people and see their suffering, I think, to recognize it's, you know, this is an emergency situation. And we're rapidly, and admittedly rapidly, trying to put in place, you know, erect ladders and rescue devices. And mm-hmm. we're trying to help people who desperately need help. And what we're hearing from us is, from people, you know, calling in is, science shouldn't be doing this. We shouldn't be trying to rescue these people. They wouldn't be in a burning building if science hadn't been in the world. And we're hearing other people carping at us saying, well, you know, in this rapid attempt to help people, there's ghosts and goblins out there, Brave New World. We're worried about cloning.
And for the life of me, I don't understand why the emphasis isn't on helping people, and of course in doing so.
Mm-hmm.
I in no way mean to imply that we in any way want to cross any moral lines,
sure.
But that discussion can take place side by side with this rapid implementation of new technology. There's no reason why not.
Sure. Phil is on the line. Hello. Phil? No Phil. Marilyn is on the line.
We're near the end of the program, so I'm just going to leave you with a couple of questions that refer to the discussion that's been taking place. Kudos to Dr. Ash on bringing up the issue about the airplanes, about the Boeing airplanes. And on the on that discussion and the fact that the your discussion yesterday on how the Bush administration is helping tobacco companies, et cetera, my two questions relate to the issue of respect for life, which we hear about so much. First, why is there more respect for potential human life than for existing life, given our policies today? And secondly, and these are on both sides of the issue.
I think we're only going to take that first question.
Okay.
We only have time for that. Adrian Ash.
We need to have respect for both potential human life and existing human life. That was what I was trying to get at. I think that unfortunately, sometimes protecting existing human life will curb things that the United States takes very seriously. Some of that is technology. Some of that is corporate activity. Some corporations are really interested in the public good. Some corporations are interested perhaps more in making money than in the public good. We clearly have corporations that have designed poor products, knowingly designed poor products, let them out, and let people die and become ill as a result of them. That is not respecting human life, and we need to do something about that. And I at least, as a bioethicist, think that is part of my charge as a bioethicist to speak out on.
Mike West?
I think it's known that I'm a pro-life. I have a huge respect for the sanctity of human life, and I would never have ever propose the technology that would destroy a human life. What we're talking about is cellular life, human cellular life, non-individualized human embryonic cells,
mm-hmm.
and using cells in the dish mm-hmm. to cure people is, I think, a moral use of technology.
Frank, I'm afraid I've got to move on. Thanks to my guest, Adrian Ash is professor of biology, ethics, and the politics of human reproduction at Wellesley College. Frank Foer is a staff writer for The New Republic, and Mike West is the CEO of Advanced Cell Technology. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website at www.theconnection.org. I'm Jack Beatty. This is The Connection. This is